Welcome back to another episode of Dentistry's Growing with Grace podcast. Join Grace and her guest of the week as they discuss lessons learned in the industry and explore unique insights into ethical growth.
Hi, and welcome to Dentistry's Growing with Grace. Today, I have one of my favorite guests, Dr. Paul Henney. Dr. Henney, thanks so much for being here with me.
Thanks for having me, Grace. It's always great to continue the conversation with you.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think a lot of people know you and they don't know they know you. So let's tell the audience a little bit about who you are. And a lot of them already know you by your name, but a lot of them know you by another name. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I am a practicing dentist. I've been practicing for like 35 years. Back in the late 90s, I formed an organization called the Bob Barkley Study Club with two other close friends of mine because we found that our experience in education in dentistry was pretty weak in the area of what I would call behavioral dentistry and psychology and that sort of thing. And this was an area that Bob Barkley was very strong in. So I became a very big, avid student of his going back really to the 1980s. And our focus has been learning more about that over a long period of time, as well as now it's evolved into teaching more and more of it. So I teach a lot of this stuff through the Bob Barkley Study Club, through workshops and other things, as well as through Facebook and whatnot.
And I always love your commentary on everything and your posts. There's always such depth to what you're talking about. And I think today we're going to be able to accomplish encouraging other people to think differently about dentistry and about the conversations that they have on a daily basis.
Yeah, and I really think that's important, Grace, because this is a conversation that I had with my wife, Betsy, 2 days ago. We were talking about how superficial most of the conversations are on Facebook and even in books and other things. And I said to Betsy, are you familiar with the word banal? And she said, no. And I said, the word banal is obvious. There's no depth to it. It's superficial. And I said, you know, most of the information, and this includes even the evening news to a large degree, most of the information that we're exposed to in our lives is banal. It's very superficial. It's not enough for you to really understand it well. And so to do these things, to explore these things, and to be effective at them, you've got to be curious enough to keep digging. And over time, what you find is a lot of things that you used to believe are wrong, or they were partially right, or you were applying it wrong, and all of these things. So, you know, this is all just about, you know, developing maturity and wisdom and whatnot. And, you know, one of the reasons that you've always appealed to me was you're like wise way beyond your years.
Yeah, thank you.
And, there are times when I'm fairly sure you were raised by my mother because if you were to ever meet my sister, she's like a clone of you. She very, very bright and analytical, and really a very strong left hemisphere kind of person that is also very right brain as well. So she went on to become a, you know, big eight CPA and CFO of the Indianapolis Zoo, and kind of brought that up into from being a local little zoo to being what it is known now, and really smart. But you remind me of my sister. Wow. She was we were raised in the Midwest. I was raised in Michigan, so you remind me a lot of my sister.
Thank you so much. I've always struggled with my age, because even when I was starting my business, like in my 20s, people would meet me and be like, what's she going to teach me about anything? And then I ended up really helping a lot of people in their business at a very young age. And even yesterday, it was funny. I was doing a video conference with a client and their audio shut down and froze, but mine didn't. So I could hear what they were saying. And so we're like in this deep conversation about their business, and they're going, she's so young. She's so young. And I'm just like, I'm still here. Like, you can't hear me. So it's fun. It's fun. It was really fun helping you out with some of the branding around what you're doing. So tell me a little bit about And I know already, but let's tell our audience a little bit about that perspective that you share with people and you're speaking in.
I've been studying the work of Bob Barkley since probably, I would say 1987. That would be 10 years after he died. And that was before I actually read his book. And his book is sort of part memoir, part guidebook. And what is stunning about it is it was very prescient. He talked about all of the problems that we're experiencing today. Bob Barkley could see them in 1972, and he was writing about them. And he was very closely associated with a guy named Nate Cohen Jr., who is a PhD psychologist. He had a PhD in educational psychology. And so that led them to basically reorganize how they communicated with their patients, how they brought them into a practice as well as through it, and how they continued to reconnect with them over time. And Bob had very long time spans when he looked at perspectives with patients, in the sense that he understood and accepted the fact that it might take a person 2 or 3 years to get ready to do the right thing. So he had processes that helped support them along the way until they were able to proceed. But his one thing is that he always stuck to, let's agree on what the right thing is, and then let's wait until you're ready to do it. Let's not do something half-baked right now that you're going to regret later. Let's just decide on what the appropriate thing is, and then let's execute that over time when you're ready to do that. And so when the neuroscience learning started to really come on board in the last 20 years, I started to think, what we know about neuroscience now completely supports everything the way Barkley and Cohen had figured it out. They didn't have the science. They just used it intuitively by working with thousands of human beings. And so that got me pretty jazzed. I thought, well, if I can bring neuroscience into this conversation, I might be able to get some dentists' attention, because dentists are, as you well know, strongly analytical, and they don't really want to talk about mushy things like social science and psychology. They just shut down. Their screen goes blank.
They want hard stats.
Right. So stats. If you can say, oh, by the way, here's the neuroscience that supports why this is a good idea, then they go, you get their attention, and you can carry the conversation a little bit farther. So that's where I do. I've kind of married together all of these things, social science, psychology, neuroscience, and really what Barkley was teaching, because at its core, it doesn't need to be changed. Human beings haven't changed since 1972. The society to varying degrees has changed. Cultural influences on human beings has changed. But human beings haven't changed. So the basic principles are all the same. Mm-hmm. So I find the topic to be endlessly interesting.
I love it. So tell me about, maybe an example of how you've applied this to either challenge people either in a one-on-one conversation or even on social media, with a topic, and then giving it a fresh perspective with the support of the neuroscience. So we can put it into practice for people.
Well, I think, all of these things sort of start out as leaps of faith. You can get it on a cognitive level. It makes sense. It's logical. I can explain to you how the brain works, and I explain to you how to create scenarios where people are going to be more receptive to what you have to hear, mm-hmm. what you have to say or share, or how much you can help them. But, it all comes down to the old adage, people don't care about what you know until they know how much you care. And so a lot of it is about just structuring social situations and being able to step back and look at your practice as a social system, as a family system, with a broad spectrum of functionality, from extremely dysfunctional to amazingly functional. Mm-hmm. That's the world we all live in. I've done practice consulting for a long period of time, and I've gone into a number of different practices and seen the whole spectrum of situations where there were multiple problems that were deeply ingrained and they were feeding on each other, mm-hmm. to amazingly symbiotic situations where there was I don't want to use the word leaderless, but they were leading as a community together. Mm-hmm. And when you see that, when you see what's possible, then you start to believe more and more in these things. So as I said, a part of this is just believing it's possible. Mm-hmm. And then, in other words, creating in your mind, and you probably did this for your business, creating in your mind what you really wanted to have happen. And then slowly taking steps, sometimes tentatively, sometimes not, in that direction, and learning a little bit more, and then making your next decision and adjustments and so on. And so Dennis, because they lean so strongly on their left hemisphere, that's what got them to the dance. That's how they got in dental school in the first place, was because they had great memories, great cognitive skills. They were logical. They could outcompete everybody in the room. And all of a sudden, they're thrown into this social science situation.
100%. So
this social science experiment called their dental practice.
Yep.
And they're hiring people that they don't really know well, and they're plugging them into their social science experiment, and then strangers are walking into their social science experiment, and then things blow up, and they go, how did that happen? What was that all about? Everybody just kind of rolls their eyes, and they don't understand, and then they blame shift, and the problems never get solved. They just say, well, people today, you know, they're different, or people, you know, that's not our fault. There's something wrong with them.
And it goes back to what you said, that they don't believe it's possible. They think, and this is what I've got some marketing phrase, and they're not even marketing phrases, but things I say around it. One of the things I say all the time is, you've got to make time to dream. So you've got to make time to have that visual idea of what your ideal looks like. So having that dedicated time to dream and train your brain to believe that that dream is possible. That's like step one. Once you actually believe it, then your physical body, your behavior, your actions are going to follow, because you believe that that's possible. You believe that you deserve it. And then you're going to create it once you believe it. But I think you're right. I think a lot of people go into it and they just think, well, this is what it is. It is what it right. is.
And you know, a lot of us come into situations where we were previously employed, or we bought a practice, so the social system was already established. Mm-hmm. Or we gather ideas and systems from our friends or our peers who have dysfunctional systems. And then we stick them into our dysfunctional system, and we just get stuck because it's kind of chaotic all the time. And it's so traumatic that we don't have time to dream. We're just in recovery at night. And so one of the ways to kind of move past all that as a dentist is that you need to get out and connect with people who have done it or who are doing it. And I mean, that's one of the purposes of the Bob Barkley Study Club workshops and so forth, as well as the Facebook page. The stuff that I'm writing about and talking about is not just stuff that I'm pulling out of the air. It's stuff that I do all the time, and a lot of my close friends do all the time. And I'm trying to share the thinking and the science and everything that supports that is in fact possible. You know, as Omar Reed supposedly famously said, if it's been done, it must be possible. So I'm just trying to show, hey, this does exist. There's science behind it. There are people that are doing it. It requires a different mindset. It requires approaching the social science experiment in a different way, thinking about it differently, all of that, but it is very possible. So that's a lot of what I do.
Yeah. And it's fun too. I've found, and I don't know how this applies, it just kind of came to me while you were talking too. I found that we've got a lot of people in leadership roles that aren't confident in their leadership, and they don't communicate with confidence. And so like, they'll try to make change in their practice, but they'll ask for permission and validation from everyone around them, even though the answer is within them. And they already know the answer, but then they go externally and they try to get approved, this approval seeking behavior. And then they go to the team, hey, what do you think about this change or that thing? And the team naturally, I think most people are not lovers of change. And so they get met with some resistance, and then they get stuck because they're looking for that validation from someplace other than within. And I don't know if that plays off of what you're talking about.
It's totally relevant. You need to have what I would call a core team, a core leadership team. In other words, you can't be the lone ranger. You need like a search party. So, yeah, and what I mean by that is a group of people. It can be maybe one or two other people, but they are people that are in alignment with how you think and how you feel and what you want to create. You share basically similar values and to a large degree a similar vision, although they may not be able to conceptualize what's in your mind. They have enough trust and faith in you that they can go along with that. They want these are people that are already willing to follow your leadership. So I would call that your core team.
And so then that gives you that validation
that gives you support.
Human, and that's probably human,
right? And when you're in the middle of an organization, let's say you have a staff of 10 or 8. And you want to make significant changes to the way you're running your social systems, you need to have a search party that's able to go in there and support each other in the process of making changes, because it's going to create some level of turmoil and chaos.
Okay.
And there's going to be pushback. There are going to be some people that, in effect, you're moving the goalposts on them. And for some people, will go, oh my God, this is like the greatest thing I've ever heard. We're finally aligning these processes with who I am too. And they become part of the search party.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be other people that go, you know, I was really happy with the way we were doing things before. I liked everything to be compartmentalized. I like to be in control of my little fiefdom. And man, these changes are a real threat to my world and I don't like it. Mm-hmm. So they might get passive aggressive. They might do other things. They might triangulate all kinds of other things. And they might stir the pot and do everything they can to not allow change to occur.
Mm-hmm.
And so you need the support of the core team to go, you know, Sally is a great employee in the relative to the way we used to do things. And she's a great person, but it's becoming time where maybe this isn't the right place for her now.
Yeah.
And so people transition in and out, and this is not a judgmental thing. This is a cultural thing.
Yeah.
Some people are going to align well with your change in the culture and some people aren't. And that's life, you know, and you've got to be willing to go in on the front end, expecting that to happen and be okay with it and be loving and kind about it. But, you know, you have moved the goalposts. You've disrupted their world. They have a right to be stressed about it. And you need to be kind about how you manage that. But keeping these people around is going to hold you back.
Yep.
You know?
And what I'm hearing too, because a lot of times I'll like march in as the leader and be like, here's this cool new thing we're going to do. And I'm basically pitching. I'm selling. Yeah. And I'm, because you're always in some state of persuasion. There's always persuasion going on, whether it's intentional or not. In any conversation, it lives there. And so what I'm hearing you say is when you can get your leadership team and persuade them first, then you're not marching in alone and you have a much powerful method of implementing the change that you need, which I didn't think I was going to get free coaching today, but I'll take it.
Yeah, I mean, dentists are notorious for doing exactly what you just described. I mean, we go to the Hinman meeting or wherever, and we see one or two great speakers that we really connected with them for philosophically or otherwise, and we come back from the meeting and we're like, I'm changing everything, or I'm changing this,
everything,
and you know. As of Monday, this is the way we're going to start to do it. And everybody on the team has seen this like 20 times now. And they're going, just wait until Friday. And the chaos around here will wear him down to the point where he'll just surrender. And we'll be back to normal the following Monday. So just bite your tongue. Don't say a word. Let it go. And that's essentially it. The social system will squeeze all of that enthusiasm and creativity out of the person unless you've got this search party that's going, no. This is like a core value. We're not surrendering on that now.
Yeah. I had a doctor call us. We had several phone calls with him and his office manager or marketing person, whatever. We put together a whole plan. He signed up, signed the contract, was ready to go. We sent the questionnaires, everything. We get a call like on a random Tuesday afternoon, someone just like screaming at us, like, I didn't sign off on this. I think it was a wife. I don't know. Way after the fact, like he was coerced. And I'm like, I have everything recorded. I'm like, what's going on? So I'm like, full all your money back, like no problem.
Right.
Because the flags were waving everywhere, you know. But it's so funny. One person who should be involved, who wasn't involved, can come in and just stop.
And that's like a really, really good point. I'm glad you brought that up. Spouses are part of your social system.
Yeah.
And so if they're not on board with this philosophically or otherwise, maybe let's invent a hypothetical Dr. Smith, which probably identifies 50% of the dentists out there, but you know, they're living a little bit beyond their means, and you know, any fluctuations in their cash flow puts a lot of stress on their family and personally. And they approach their spouse about wanting to change this or that, and these changes on the front end might disrupt things and might even cause a slight reduction in income to muscle your way through some of these more difficult changes.
For the short term to get to
and immediately the spouse is gonna go, whoa, wait a minute. You know, I'm not really interested in giving up anything. I'm not really interested in making any sacrifices for this philosophical, you know, journey that you apparently are on that you're probably gonna get tired of in 2 weeks. I'm like not on board with it. So, you know, you've got to look at the whole picture.
Yeah.
Family members are part of your social system. So everything that you decide to do, you need to have everybody on board with this.
I want to be a little challenging in this because my husband and I, totally different human beings, and it works. It's what God gave me for a reason. So he is super easygoing, very routine, doesn't like a lot of change. I'm like addicted to change and growth, very entrepreneurial. Love business, love challenge, everything. And so when I present change to him, he shuts it down every time. Like he's never really been like, oh my gosh, great idea. Let's go for it. He's like, whatever you think. Now we've evolved to whatever you think, because I'll have to edit that out. But we've evolved to whatever you think because it used to be that it was this continual roadblock. So we had a very real conversation of, dear, I love you, but you need to get out of my way. And we've found our different roles. And so when it comes to like moving the business, he's no longer a part of the search party, because it was like carrying around like a little, like a weight, just because we're so different. So I don't know. I think,
well, you know, your situation, I'm assuming he works and all that. So no, he doesn't work.
He does not work anymore. He used to. I begged him to quit his career to help me with my business when we started having children. And he did. And then we couldn't work together. So I was like, you need to go. And so now, no, he does not work. But he does work very hard in the home with the kids in a different
way. Oh yeah. So you kind of have a inversion of the more classical roles that society has seen. And that's fantastic that you can do that, that you're both suited well for that and can adapt to that.
Yeah.
Most situations aren't like that. Most situations today have both spouses working. And so there's a lot of tension about, you know, how much free time there is, and you're going to make significant changes in the way you're running your practice. How is that going to influence me and all the obligations that I have inside and outside the home? And so it's a very tenuous situation that doesn't take much to tip it out of balance and create a lot of problems.
I don't know how it works for us, but I think it's sometimes finding that balance for in each individual situation, what's going to work for you. For some reason, it just works better for us that he's got his functions, I have mine, and it's worked. But I could see, I think the trouble comes in where you don't know where that person's role is. How involved are they? If they only step into the business to poo-poo the progress and the growth, then there's got to be a conversation there, I think. Because I think a lot of spouses aren't really in the search party, but they just pop their head in when it has to do with money. And that's, I think, a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, it's complicated. And, you know, that the things that worked for you when you first got married, when you make significant changes to them later on down the road, that may cause a lot of disruptions. For instance, if your husband's sense of self was strongly tied to him having a certain kind of a job and you request him not to work, that could create a lot of problems in some relation. Yeah,
it did.
Our society tends to say, you know, males' significance in the society is really associated with the kind of work that they do and how much money they make. So these are complicated things.
Absolutely. There's societal pressure everywhere. I'm really blessed that my husband is highly intelligent. He's very cerebral. He was able to realize that was an outside force and embrace his new role unapologetically to the people around him. And that's the reason it worked for us, is because he's so smart and so strong.
That requires a lot of, a strong self-identity just to be able to let go of that and move on into some pretty unexplored territory.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's fun. So, when you're talking about the science of these things and when you're talking about like the neuroscience and how it relates, how would you apply some of these decision makers? Like, I just want to dig a little deeper into that so that people know a little bit more what you're all about when you lecture and things like that.
I spent a fair bit of time just talking about how the brain and the mind works. And if you understand sort of how the brain evolved over time, over hundreds of thousands of years, we essentially have three brains. And they work in unison, but they also influence each other. They influence each other in positive and negative ways, and depending on the circumstances. So in any situation that's perceived as threatening, and that may be real or imagined, it may be based on beliefs, any situation that's perceived as threatening immediately makes the limbic system dominant. And when the limbic system is dominant, you're not thinking clearly. You're thinking about survival, basically. So you're in fight or flight. You're in constant assessment. You're stressed. You're trying to figure out what the most appropriate thing to do is under this potentially threatening situation. So what is one of the, you know, if I was...
I call them triggers.
Yeah.
And one of my friends calls it when he calls it being hijacked, his brain being hijacked.
Right. So if I had a dollar for every patient that told me they would rather have a baby than go to the dentist or something like that, that would be a pretty good metric of how psychologically stressful dentistry is to an awful lot of the public. Mm-hmm. I think we as dentists are, because we're in it all the time, we grow insensitive to that. We're stressed about other things, and we're not paying attention to how stressed they are about things that are completely normalized to us. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the keys to connecting with patients better is creating environments that's more supportive of them feeling safe and secure. And that begins even before the first appointment. That begins through marketing initiatives and phone contact initiatives and a whole series of moments that either support their preconceptions or undercut them. And so if you think, as I was saying, even before we got online here, marketing to me is everything. Marketing is everything that happens in your practice before, during, and after you have contact with people. Mm-hmm. And if you look at it from that point of view, and then you infuse in that your understanding of neuroscience and how you can structure experiences, the series of experiences going backward and forward, how can you structure an experience that supports them feeling safe and hence more open to learning and understanding and potentially changing their belief system to a degree that they're more likely to say yes to appropriate care instead mm-hmm. of letting their limbic system drive their decision making, which is, I'll do as little as possible so I can get the heck out of here.
Yep.
Or to create a situation that's kind of co-creative, and you're not only thinking about today, but you're thinking about the future. You're thinking about what are the implications of what's happening today? What does that mean to me? Do I want to end up in the same place that happened to my mom? Do I want to experience the same thing my dad is experiencing now that he's transitioned into assisted living and they're losing his dentures every month? Do I want to go there? I've got a choice. You know, I'm only 50 now. I've got some choices, but I am at a crossroad. What does that all that mean to me? If you can't, with some intention, create conversations and experiences for your patients that allow that kind of relationship to evolve and openness and honesty without manipulation. If you can't do that, you're not really going to get very much acceptance of comprehensive care, and you're really not going to be able to move your practice from being what I would call transactional into being more holistic in its purpose. Mm-hmm. So it's our ability to establish quality relationships with our patients drives everything else downstream. And that really begins with the quality relationships we have with our team. So going back to our search party conversation, if patients come into our environment and maybe they connect with us really well, but then we hand the relationship off to Betty, who's, you know, going through a divorce with her husband, Bob, and is stressed out and can't connect with anybody because she's totally in her limbic system all the time.
Yeah.
All your work just got undercut. You know, so you know, this is hard work. I'm not trying to paint some utopian la-di-da land that you can just turn the switch on and do tomorrow. But I'm saying, you know, this is where, in my mind anyways, where the fun of dentistry is when you get past just fixing teeth and you move towards significantly helping people with their life, the quality of their life. That's really, and get paid for it well, you know? Yeah.
And I am connecting with everything that you're saying on such a level, I can't even put it into words. But I want to say it's like a light bulb moment when you go from, like, I used to walk around the office and just say to my team, do you need help with anything? Do you have questions with anything? Is there anything I can do for you? And I'd get all good, all good, all good. And then I stopped listening to words. And I started putting a whole lot more energy into facial expressions, nonverbal communication, lack of eye contact during certain situations. And I started reading beyond the words on a much deeper level and have gotten so much further in business and in life in connecting and helping people, because it's not about what people say to you. The words are not the reality.
Right. Are you familiar with the acronym MWA? It's an old from Peters. It's called management by walking around.
That's what I do.
Yep. And that's it. It's about just turning on your other senses and paying attention to kind of all of the nonverbal communication that's going on in the room or in the practice or in the business. And that's really where you start to identify the problems, the tension between two people, or where somebody's really struggling, or where your systems are breaking down, or whatever that might be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really fun to be observing on a different level and to be continually growing in that area, because it just makes you such a stronger leader. And then the next step from that was recognizing, but then having the right verbal tools to get people to open up and feel safe and be able to dig deeper in those conversations. It's really exciting stuff. And honestly, Dr. Henny, I would love to hear you speak. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners and viewers would love to hear you speak as well. How can people get in touch with you? Maybe to educate their event or to learn more about how you might be able to help them.
Well, on the speaking side of things, you can just go to paulhenny.com, and that's my speaker site. So it has several of the things that I teach. If in addition to that, you can just, you know, become a friend of the Bob Barkley Study Club Facebook page, because we're constantly having conversations exactly like this, as well as I'll put up some promotional things for this and that as I'm doing events around the country. Coming up on April 3rd to 4th, I'll be at the Mendina Country Club, not too far from where you are right now.
That is so, 1 mile away from me.
Yeah.
Right now.
So Gary Takis will be there with me.
When's the date?
April 3rd and 4th. Yeah.
I'm a member. I'm a nerdy member there.
Yeah.
April 3rd and 4th. Oh my gosh. If I can be at that, I would love to attend.
We'd love to have you there. So, you know, Gary Takis will be there. A very good friend of mine named Brian Vence will be there. He's probably one of the finest restorative dentists in the country. He practices there in Chicago. He's brilliant, and he understands a lot of this psychosocial connection with people. And he does a lot of big comprehensive care cases because he understands how people think, and he understands how to help them work through what I call a complex sale. When somebody's making a decision to buy from you comprehensive dentistry that maybe takes a year or two or more, that's a complex sale. That doesn't happen in a day or a minute. That takes sometimes years for somebody to decide to do that. And so you need to understand how to establish relationships that support the facilitation of complex sales. So we talk about that. And Brian will be there and talking a little bit about that as well. So we'd love to have you there. It would be fun.
Oh my goodness. Well, I'll be there, and I'll definitely share the details with my friends as well, so that anybody who's interested can sign up. So cool.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. So
let's do it again sometime.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's book it. So for anyone interested, again, it's the Bob Barkley Study Club. Please follow it on Facebook. Really great information. And Dr. Henny, thank you again for being here. And thank you to all of our viewers and listeners for being a part of Dentistry's Growing with Grace. And you can always find me in our Facebook group, Dental Marketing with Grace. Thanks, and have a great day.
Thank you, Grace.